I'm Joe Bianca.
I'm Bill Finley.
I'm Jonathan Green.
They say the harder the work, the greater the reward. This is our life's work.
Good morning. It is 9:05 Wednesday, January 27th. This is the TDN Writers Room presented by Keeneland. My name is Joe Bianca. I'm the associate editor of the Thoroughbred Daily News. And to steal a line from John, there's just one shopping day left until my birthday.
Oh, almost happy birthday to you, Joe. I'm Bill Finley, a correspondent for the Thoroughbred Daily News.
Jonathan Green, general manager of DJ Stable. And Joe, ironically enough, your birthday coincides with my dog's birthday as well. It is Newman Green's birthday today.
Newman? Seinfeld Newman?
Newman. We got him when he was 8, and apparently he was from a shelter, and the idea was, the guy who owned him owned a halfway house, and the idea was that when you came through the halfway house, you left a new man, and that's why he named the dog Newman.
Mm. Wow. That's deep, man.
It's a lot deeper than I would have been done, because we usually name our dogs like Blue or actually, right. Ironically enough, we have Lane's End, coming on today. And my original dog was a Kentucky bred, and we named her Indy after AP Indy. That is a true story.
I heard that one. You also have a dog named Blue?
We had a dog named Blue, and we have a dog named Luke. Yes, a thread of, we have a horse, a thread of Blue. Exactly. I see you wearing the chapeau, which I appreciate very much.
Named after the dog or no?
Yeah, a little bit. It all works out together, but that would be a whole nother podcast. We don't have time for that today, but I appreciate it.
Yeah, I mean, we started talking about my birthday and we ended up talking about your dogs for four minutes.
It's always about, it's always what it's always about, even the show. But happy birthday to you. You don't look a day over 30.
Appreciate it.
All right. Anytime. And speaking of looking 30, Bill, I got a question for you before we start.
Yes, John.
Okay. So baseball came out and announced yesterday that they are not electing anybody into the
right.
If you had a vote, would you have voted for Roger Clemens, Bonds, or Curt Schilling?
No, no, and no.
Really? No across the board?
Straight across the board, no, no, no.
A no trifecta for Bill Finley.
Yes, sir.
Okay.
Two steroid guys and a crazed, whacked out, bad guy, Curt Schilling. So there you go.
Everyone knows there's no bad guys in the Hall of Fame. So yeah. keep that streak up.
Exactly. No, that's good. Listen, I can't argue with it. I would concur with at least the PED users. Curt Schilling, even though I don't agree with his political rants, he won some, humanitarian awards when he was a player. So it's a little hard to like.
Eventually we'll talk about horse racing this morning, I'm sure. But there is a clause of a character clause in the balloting for the Hall of Fame. I mean, the guy recently sent out a tweet praising the terrorists at the Capitol. I mean, if that doesn't violate the character clause, what does?
Right. Well said. Well said. Okay, back to your birthday show. I mean, back to the show.
The TDN Writers Room is brought to you by Keeneland. A reminder that wagering through Keeneland Select supports Keeneland's efforts to give back to the thoroughbred industry as profits are reinvested back into the sport through purses, fan development, player rewards, and more. Sign up at KeenelandSelect.com. That spring meet will be here before you know it, so get involved. So we had an answer over the weekend to our question last week of whether there was any cachet or any interesting horses in the Pegasus World Cup, and there's one horse that I think is pretty interesting now, and that would be the runaway winner, Nix Go. Now, we have a horse who was pretty much completely turned around by Brad Cox. He was an okay 2-year-old and 3-year-old, but really has just found new life for the Brad Cox barn. Is now 4-for-4 since joining that trainer, and has had blowout wins. Just hasn't even been challenged at all, really. And this was clearly his biggest test yet. And he just is so fast that you put him on the lead, and it's kind of lights out because of how quickly he can run and still keep going. Now he went 23-46-109 and just never looked like a loser the entire race, and one gear down at the end. So he proved that he can go at least 9 furlongs. Question remains if he can go a mile and a quarter. He doesn't have to go a mile and a quarter for the Saudi Cup. And we'll talk a little bit about that and the prospective matchup of him versus Charlotte. And I think clearly the two most exciting horses in racing right now. Otherwise, in the race, I thought Independence Hall ran well to be third. I thought that was a good performance from him, and you know, a horse that had kind of fallen off after showing early talent as a 3-year old. I think it was important for him to have that kind of performance to springboard his 4-year old season. But the race was all about Nick's Go, and you know, he's a monster. I don't know how else to explain it, and how else to explain like how he's this horse compared to who he was at 2 and as an early 3-year old. But he's a total freak, and you know, he's obviously carrying the flag for Painter. It's like Painter might have a little bit of a resurgence and mares coming to him after these performances, but I don't know what else there is to say other than he's a total monster and clearly is either 1 or 1A in the handicap division right now.
Joe, just to add to some of the things that you said, I mean, the before and after of Brad Cox versus Ben Colebrook the previous, and I don't mean this as any sort of knock on Ben Colebrook, is as dramatic as anything perhaps we've ever seen. I mean, we're used to guys like Brad Cox getting the most out of horses, improving them when they get into his barn. But, you know, this is a horse that, you know, for most of his 3-year-old year, couldn't get out of his own way, you know, running buyers in the 80s, et cetera. Now he's running 108, 108, 107 buyers for Brad Cox, including the win in the Breeders' Cup Dirt Mile. And he's got him at a point now where I agree. I mean, you know, unless he goes up against Charlatan, who do you see beating this horse? And what makes him so devastating is, and this is a rare thing, you don't see a lot of horses, he can get out there and go a 45 half or go 109 and change for 6 furlongs and just keep going. And you put that speed and then combine it with an ability to finish and stamina. And that's, you know, almost an unbeatable combination. So, again, I don't have the answer for why he's so much better now than he was before. But, I mean, this horse right now is just, like you said, I think you use the word monster. And that's a very good way of doing it. And I think in some respects, too, he really helped the Pegasus because, you know, after him, there really wasn't a horse in there that, you know, unless something unusual happened, you would look at and say, wow, you know, what a nice horse, what a worthy Pegasus winner going down with Gunrunner, Arrowgate, and some of the others. This horse now, you know, might belong in that same breath with a Gunrunner, Arrowgate. He's not there yet, but he's certainly heading in that direction. So, you know, in some respects, you know, he added some class and some prestige and some pizzazz to the Pegasus when we were worried leading up to it that wasn't going to be the case at all.
Yeah, you guys nailed all my major points. I mean, when we look at racehorses that we're looking to buy something, you know, that's already run, one of the key components is, does the horse have early speed? Because it just allows you as you know, as the horse to be able to dictate to the others in the race what they need to do. They need to watch out for you as opposed to you waiting for a hole to open up or for a break to occur in a race. So to have early turn of foot is really, really important and an added component, you know, again, when we personally look for horses. Nick's Go for the majority of his career showed that early speed. And as both of you have noted, you know, he would go out there in 22 and change in 23 and 46 and then just couldn't continue that high rate of speed, which most horses cannot do. And however, you know, Brad Cox has been able to do it, he's been able to, you know, elongate that process and have a horse like Nick's Go not only go out in 22 and 4 and 46 in this specific race in the Pegasus, but then finish up in 109 and 4, 134 and 4. I mean, his split times were basically plus or minus 23 seconds every quarter mile. And that just doesn't happen for a mile race, a mile and eighth race, you know, consistently. So it's amazing what this, you know, what this group has been able to do to get Nick's Go to elongate his speed. And I remember very distinctly right before the race, watching the race on TVG, and they were discussing, as the horses were going into the gate, they were discussing, you know, well, what is the over-under speed for a half mile that Nick's Go should be able to run in without having a problem? And if he goes faster than that, you know, is he vulnerable? And you know, they all agreed that if the horse went a first half in, you know, faster than 46 and 4, that he was going to be vulnerable. Well, he went 4/5 of a second faster than that, basically 4 lengths faster than that, and never looked back. So it was just unusual. You know, you look at a horse like this, and he's made a complete 180 turnaround since he's been in this barn. And now he's at the top of the game, you know, running another 108 buyer. So it'll be interesting to see what he does overseas. But he's been remarkable since he came over from into the Brad Cox barn. I do want to mention one other thing that I thought was interesting that kind of came out was, you know, NICSCO is owned by the Korea Racing Authority, and Glenda Sernick's been very outspoken, and rightfully so, about not selling horses to Korea for horses to end up, you know, not racing and basically becoming, you know, alternative foods. So I thought it was interesting that, you know, that those two groups got together in the winner's circle in the trophy room after that race. That must have been a very interesting conversation.
Didn't expect that conversation to go there. But yeah, once the Knicks go went 21-4 and 44-1 in the dirt mile and kept going, I don't think there's any limit to what he's able to accomplish. I mean, that race, if there were ever a race that would have him coming up gasping in the lane, that would be it. And he still won gear down. So I wouldn't put any fractions past him, which is why it's going to be so interesting to see him against Charlatan. Now, Charlatan can rate a little bit. He's able to sit a little bit off the speed, but he's also very fast. So I don't know, you know, that might be the unstoppable force against the immovable object when those two meet up. And I think that's why it's so intriguing. And you know, that's kind of what a race like the Saudi Cup is for this early in the season, to get those kind of Breeders' Cup-esque matchups that you would get with those two clashing. So hopefully we can see that. I wanted to shout out NBC, who did a really good job on the broadcast. I thought it was really well done, considering how much it is being done remotely. There are a lot of people there at Gulfstream at the Pegasus. It made me a little nervous, honestly, to see that many people in the stands. But I guess it's Florida, so it's all bets are off. But nevertheless, still a terrific day of racing. I wanted to touch on some of the other races that we saw on Pegasus Day. Obviously, Colonel Liam won the other big grade one, the Pegasus Turf. I thought he was a terrible bet at 5-2. I thought it was just complete underlay, but, you know, he proved me wrong. He's obviously got a world of talent. He only got a 99 buyer, which for a $1 million turf race, you would hope to see something a little bit higher than that. But the way he did it, you know, I think the way he did it visually is more important than anything. Todd Butcher says he's going to point him to the Woodford Reserve Turf Classic, or maybe the Old Forester Turf Classic at this point. Some bourbon sponsored Turf Classic on the Churchill, on the Derby undercard at Churchill. So we'll look forward to that. He's obviously an exciting horse. Otherwise, Performer got a little revenge for his dud in the Cigar Mile. But I thought, you know, he had such a good trip, and he barely beat Eye of the Jedi, who I picked. That was a little bit of a tough beat at 11-1 there. But, you know, I think Performer now has shown that he really isn't a top class horse. I think he's a nice enough horse, but there was hope with him beating up on these allowance horses and winning the Discovery that he was eventually going to become a grade one miler. And I think he's proven that's not the case. He's a pretty good horse, but he's no superstar. Otherwise, you had Zafel and Always Shopping, who were really sharp winners on the turf in the Marshes River and the La Prevoyant, respectively. Big upset from Pacific Gale in the Inside Information. I bet her in her debut. So now Al hits me up every time that she wins. Like, did you have her? Like, no, of course I didn't have her in that race. 16-1 and blew up my pick four right away. Tide of the Sea in the WL McKnight is a horse that Mike Maker has really turned around into a graded stakes winner on turf. So it was a terrific day of racing, but, you know, the story was whether or not the Pegasus was going to live up to its past runnings. And, you know, NICSCO was pretty much the only reason it did. And, you know, we talk about speed and how dangerous speed is. I think about, you know, I honestly usually am, as a handicapper, I lean more towards respecting speed when it comes to cheaper races, because a lot of times what can happen in like a bottom level claimer or a maiden claimer, the horse just kind of goes out to the front and bottoms out the rest of the field, makes them run faster than they can capably run first. And then as is the case with most dirt races, they're decelerating in the last quarter mile. So it's going to be harder for those cheaper horses to rally after having to run faster than they wanted to early in the race. So I usually look for speed in those kind of races, but it's tougher to do it at a top class level. And I think, you know, the last race that I've seen that really reminds me of that, where horse just keeps, goes super fast early and keeps going, was Arrogate in the Travers. Now, this wasn't as brilliant in terms of buyer figures. Arrogate got a 122. He shattered the track record at Saratoga. But I thought that was where Arrogate really turned the corner and proved that he was a superstar, when he was able to go out there and set those fast fractions and keep going like he hadn't done that. And I think this was that kind of race for Nick Sko. Obviously, he had that race in the dirt mile. But this race against clear grade one competition, even though it wasn't the strongest Pegasus field, definitely some grade one horses in there. For him to keep going after going that fast, I don't know. I feel like the sky's the limit for him. And I wonder if you guys have any thoughts about a potential matchup with Charlatan in the Saudi Cup and what to expect.
Yeah, well, first of all, I'm not entirely sure. I talked to Brad Cox this week, and he was a little bit on the fence about what he's going to do. I think you're probably right. I think he probably will wind up in the Saudi Cup, but he's also looking at the Dubai World Cup as something that he wants to take a look at. And again, you know, they're what, 5-6 weeks apart and all the travel and everything. So it's not a case where you would automatically run in both. But I mean, I don't know who would win that. I mean, but it would be fascinating. I love races like this. And we get so few of them where you get horses that are just so superior, such superior talents, and they meet on the racetrack. But, you know, and also it's not just how they finish, but how does a race like that set up? Now, you're right. Charlatan did race in second in the Malibu, but, you know, that was in a 7-furlong sprint race. You know, he wants to go right to the front. Nick Sko is, you know, doesn't look like a horse you could ever even take off the pace. So, you know, what is that? What happens in a race if these two meet so far as the kind of pace battle? I mean, I could see them going head to head, toe to toe, every step of the way until maybe one yields at the eighth pole or something. And again, they're both so talented. I don't think they would create a speed duel and set it up for somebody else. I think it would still be one of them. I mean, I would obviously rather see the matchup of these two horses happen on U.S. soil than in foreign soil. But if we're going to get a chance to see him compete in the Saudi Cup, I mean, that would be great, great racing.
Yeah, I think if the two of them went head-to-head in a race like that, there would be like a sonic boom, because they would just be going so fast that everyone else, you know, in the race would just, you know, back up, because there'd be, you know, they'd be going, breaking the sound barrier. And we can talk about that race, I think, in the future as we get closer to it and we know, you know, who else is going to be there. But Joe, I did want to circle back to a couple of the races. I mean, Colonel Liam and Largent, you know, really showed that they both are, you know, top horses. I'm not going on a limb by saying that. And I know, yeah, you'd say, all right, a 99 buyer is probably not a great buyer for a race of a grade one race of that caliber, but it actually was a career best for Colonel Liam. So he's a lightly raced horse. He's only run about half a dozen times, and I think he's getting better and progressing as it goes. Todd Pletcher had the exact end of that race, so we don't mention Todd's name as much of late, but obviously he had those two horses, you know, ready to go in that race. I thought it was interesting also in the inside information, Pacific Gale, you know, you'd mentioned you liked her early on. That's a filly, a mare, excuse me, that hasn't won a race in over 2 years. You know, she went 0-16 before winning the grade two inside information. So, you know, maybe John Kimmel, you know, figure out a way to get her to her best back down at Gulfstream Park, where she hadn't run in over a year. The other thing that's interesting is the inside information, which is a grade two, the Pegasus World Cup turf grade one, and the Pegasus Invitational grade one, were all three finishers in all three races Keeneland grads.
Wow. So shout out to the sponsor. Good tidbit by you, John. You got to filling in for Al here in that regard. But yeah, one thing that was interesting about the Pegasus turf was that there was no European participation. I felt like in the past couple of years of that race, there had been at least a couple of horses that were shipping in from Europe. Now, maybe it's just a function of who's available at this time of year in 2021. But you know, you'd like to see a little bit more European participation for $1 million turf race, especially now that the Arlington Million is basically kaput. There's not that many of those left in America right now.
Yo, I think they came here and ate our lunch at the Breeders' Cup and went home, quite frankly. I mean, how many Euros did so well in turf races, you know, over that weekend?
I think the primary reason there's no Europeans is COVID. You can do it, but it's so much more difficult that I think, you know, and Aidan O'Brien would be the guy who would lead the charge normally with European horses. So I'm just, you know, speculating that the answer was that if this is just too difficult, it's not worth it. So, you know, we'll see you at the Breeders' Cup.
Right.
They're not paying their fees like the Breeders' Cup does to come over here. But yeah, just in terms of whether or not we're going to see that Knicks go Charlatan matchup, even if we don't see it in the Saudi Cup, you know, assuming they can stay healthy, which you never know, especially in Charlatan's case, might not be too easy. Even if we don't see it in the Saudi Cup or the Dubai World Cup, I think there's a good chance that the landing spot for both of them when they come back to America is the Met Mile. You know, they got almost a full 3 months off between the Dubai World Cup and the Met Mile. There's a couple other spots later in the year. Obviously, you would hope that they would clash in the Breeders' Cup, but I think it's something that we're going to see, if not in the Saudi Cup, then definitely later in the year, and maybe multiple times as well. And that would be nice. That would be something that would be interesting for racing, to create that kind of rivalry between two top class horses, because we really don't have that anymore in racing. I don't even know what the last great rivalry would be. You know, I can't even think of it. Maybe a couple of fillies. Not sure. But I think we're going to see that eventually, even if we don't see it in the Saudi Cup. But hopefully we will see it in the Saudi Cup. And hopefully, you know, Saudi Cup doesn't withhold the purses from anybody after whoever wins. All right. So we were stretching for a little bit for 3-year-old content, but I think that's going to change as the months go on, definitely as we get closer to May. But even like coming into late January, early February, we've got the Holy Bowl this Saturday at Gulfstream. Might find a Derby contender or two in there. But I thought there were three really promising performances by sophomore colts over the weekend. One was in a stake, two were in maiden races. The one in the stake was a horse that I made a TDN Rising Star, Cattle River, who I said last week was super fast, but there was a question about whether or not he could sustain it. This was the first time going two turns. And goddamn, did he sustain it? I mean, he went fast and was just blew the field apart on the far turn. Didn't even wait until they got into the stretch. Turned for home completely by himself and just poured it on the stretch and one gear down, I think by 10 1/4 lengths, something like that. Got a 92 buyer, so probably not the strongest field behind him. Although, like I said, Cowan has run some good races and he was second in there. So I wouldn't completely write off the field, but obviously he had things his own way. He is crazy sharp. And, you know, again, 1 1/4, a lot different than a mile when you have that kind of speed and you face off against a lot of other one-way speed in the Derby. But, you know, Brad Cox, the 1-2 punch, at least 1-2, he might have a couple other horses, but the 1-2 punch of Cattle River and Essential Quality, I think those are the kind of horses you want to have in the Derby. You want to have one speed at least and one stalker slash closer. That way you kind of have your bases covered depending on what the pace of the race is. You're not victimized either way by a super slow pace or a super fast pace. So, you know, that's a devastating 1-2 punch for him and Kettle River. You know, I felt very validated by that performance, making him a rising star, because he was incredibly impressive. And I think still has forward to go. And we'll see what happens as the distances get longer. And then the other two were in maiden races. You had the Great One, who had run a couple of times, but won by 14+ lengths on Saturday at Santa Anita. Doug O'Neill said he's going to end up in most likely in the San Felipe next, where he might meet Life is Good from Bob Baffert's barn. So that's a matchup to look forward to as well. And then I think the one that really got everybody buzzing was Prevalence on Saturday at Gulfstream. And it was one of those, you know, 7-furlong elongated sprint races with a lot of really well bred, highly regarded, high purchase price horses. You had a half brother to Justify in there. There was a Todd Pletcher horse who cost $1 million at Keeneland September. And Prevalence, you know, took a lot of heat. You know, this is the kind of performance you really want to see from a 3-year-old. Took a lot of heat, and there was like a 5-way pace battle early on, and they kind of just dropped off one by one until it was just him left. And you think, okay, well, he won the battle, he's going to lose the war, but no, he completely dominated in the stretch. Never showed any signs of stopping. One gear down by Tyler Gaffleon, but I think about 7.5 lengths. Got an 89 buyer, son of Medaglia Doro. He's an interesting horse in that he was working on the turf. I always wonder with trainers when they work horses on both the dirt and the turf and then run them on the dirt. I'm not sure what that's about. I would like love to ask friend of the show Brennan Walsh about that. But another one for Godolphin. I mean, you want to talk about Godolphin being loaded as well as Brad Cox for the Derby. The big story this year of the Derby so far is whether or not Godolphin's going to be able to finally win their first one. got essential quality. He's going to be named champion, two-year-old tomorrow night. So he's obviously the top contender, but Prevalence is right there. And then Proxy, who was second in the LeCompte last week, I think are both big-time contenders as well, especially Prevalence because the sky's the limit with him. But, yeah, I mean, that's that was, I thought, one of the best debut performances I've seen in years. You know, forget what the buyer number was, just the way he did it and the way he shrugged off all of that heat and kept going. He was like 7-1 or so, you know, got bet down from a 12-1 morning line, but a horse that good, you know, that's a pretty, they did a good job keeping the secret, even just to be 7-1 in that race, because, you know, he obviously was head and shoulders above everybody. And I think that might end up becoming a key race down the line for more three-year-olds that are going to win stakes races. But any thoughts on you guys from any of those three-year-old performances?
Yeah, Joe, I'll tackle Prevalence. And I agree with you. It was just a tremendous performance in there. Couple of things. I think one of the reasons why, and I was surprised too, in the aftermath, you know, why wasn't this horse 4-5 or 6-5, something like that? But a couple of things there. I think, first of all, I believe it was a 12-horse field. So, you know, if it was a 6-horse field, that would have made a difference in the odds. And also, there were so many other places for the Sharpies and the Wise Guys and even the $2 better to land on with the half brother to justify you know, the Todd Pletcher $1 million horse and everything like that. So, you know, there's a couple stories that are coming, going to come out of this. And you're absolutely right. It's going to be fascinating to see if Godolphin can pull this off. I mean, they've been trying for well over 20 years to win the Kentucky Derby. They've never even had a horse finish in the top three in any of their attempts to win the Derby. And going back even years before that, and John will remember this, you might be a little bit too young, Joe, but they were trying to win the Derby by going through the preps in Dubai, the UAE Derby, and it was just a disaster. Now they're trying it the, you know, more conventional way. So with essential quality and Prevalence, you know, they have two big guns for the Kentucky Derby. But one thing I'll say about Prevalence and kind of the negative, though, is until Justify won the Kentucky Derby, there was still this, you know, big what if, or you can't do it because you didn't have a start as a two-year-old. Now, nobody even talks about that anymore. Could it be that that's still a very important point and then Justify was just an outlier? He was so good he was able to do it. So, you know, with Prevalence, I still worry about the late start to his career, even though it was January, not February or March, for him getting started in his career. So, you know, I want to see what he does in his next start. Talk to Brendan Walsh, not sure where he's going to go there. But everything you said about him being an exciting horse, having run just an eye-opening debut, I totally agree with.
Yeah, and things are starting to shake out as far as, you know, top contenders. I think the Kentucky Derby pool, second pool, just came out, and there was still a horse that was unraced. That was one of the top 10 contenders, according to odds. So the odds makers, the smart money still doesn't feel like before this weekend that there were any, you know, really top killers that were coming to the front. I think until this weekend, and this weekend really impressed me on those three performances. A buddy of mine actually, you know, sent me a text after Cattle River saying, oh, you know, if Cowan wasn't bothered, then, you know, it would have been a different race. Cattle River was so much better in that race. You know, it was unbelievable. Ran a 92 buyer and it wasn't even close. Now, does Cowan have talent? Absolutely. And maybe if he got a clean trip, he would have been closer, but he's still a horse to watch. But Cattle River just, you know, basically propelled himself to, you know, to the top 10 list. Prevalence, you already mentioned, you know, 7-1. That's how deep the pool was of horses in that race, that they didn't really have a line as to just how good the horse was. And listen, it is not easy. It is not an easy feat to ask a first time starter to win going 7/8 of a mile, because that is really, like Joe, you mentioned elongated sprint. It's like a marathon for a firster, even horses that you think can go two turns, because you have to stay on throttle for the, you know, for the majority, if not all, of the race, and distance horses just aren't used to doing that. So it really wasn't more, I think, even more impressive win than just the fact that the horse won by 9 lengths and beat a talented field of maidens, you know, in the teeth of the championship meet at Gulfstream. To answer your question before, I've actually asked a couple of trainers, you know, that like to train young horses on the dirt and on the turf. And they tell me it's for two reasons. One is, if they're not sure if the horse has got, you know, more talent on the turf or the dirt, which usually means he's slow on the dirt, then they try him on the turf. The other thing, the other rationale, and I think it probably is, you know, more so for Prevalence than the first reason, is sometimes when you have these horses that are you know, so talented, they get bored training. They get bored doing what you're asking them to do. So you change it up a little bit by having them go on the turf, and they're like, "Ooh, what's this surface? This is kind of new." And it re-energizes them and gets them to refocus on training. And horses that are really talented, sometimes they get a little goofier, a little nonchalant about their training because it's boring to them to go a half a mile in 48 when they can do it easily in 46 and change. So I think that might be the rationale behind prevalence, not having asked this specific trainer, you know, why dirt and turf breezes. And then finally, the great one, which was a really interesting race, even though it was only a typical, you know, California race, four horse field. And the great one won, you know, impressively, but he wasn't even the favorite in the race. A first time starter named Bill.
Fenway,
exactly. Fenway was actually the favorite in the race, even though the great one lost by a nose to Spielberg in the grade two the race before. So that's how much they thought Fenway was so much more talented than the rest of the field. Fenway was the favorite of a horse that finished second in a grade two the race before. So, you know, I think the great one, even though he only defeated three other horses, that's going to be kind of a race we're going to look back at as well and say, well, who were the other three? Oh, okay. It was, you know, Fenway, it was this. And I think we're going to look back at that group also and see a couple of them in some of these other Derby preps, you know, coming down the lane. So big weekend for, you know, for two maiden races on the, what kind of impact they'll have on the Triple Crown.
Yeah. And I think this is like an interesting time of year because those maiden races can share billing with the graded stakes for three-year-olds, because I think everyone is so, you know, it's so early in everyone's, you know, prep schedule and development for their three-year-old year is that, you know, it is, you know, it does become too late at some point, like Bill was alluding to have a horse win have a big performance in a maiden race and then be a realistic chance for the Derby. But I don't think it's too early yet. And I think, you know, it was one of those things where if prevalence debuted December 31st instead of January 23rd, I don't think that makes that big of a difference in terms of their, you know, their progression towards the Derby. So yeah, there are going to be some interesting maiden races, I think, at least for the next couple of weeks that might have implications for the Derby. I mentioned the Holy Bull before, but just wanted to touch on that real quick, just to see who's probable. You have Sitting on Go, who won the Iroquois last year at Churchill on a big upset, who still could be pretty good. Son of Brody's Cause. Then you have, Muta Sabek, who won the Mucho Macho Man for Todd Pletcher. And then Todd Pletcher also might have in that race Prime Factor, who I think is one of those maiden winners that could go on to big things. He won by 8 3/4 lengths first time out, got a TDN Rising Star badge. He was a $900,000 son of Quality Road. So super highly regarded. I think was really well bet in that race as well. So those are the main three I would look for this Saturday. But, you know, I think there's a couple other horses that will probably show up in the entries that could make some noise as well. So yeah, we're, like I said last week, we're going to get into it like pretty quickly. It's all going to start snowballing for this Derby prep schedule. It's great this year to have, you know, at least so far, I think we'll be good at having the Derby on time this year. I don't think they're going to push it back. Whether or not there'll be fans there, we'll see, but I think we're pretty locked in for May 1st. So it's going to be fun. It's going to be fun the next couple of months to have that traditional Derby prep schedule back, because last year was cool in that, you know, it was good for the contest to have so many prep races and it like really changed the complexion of the Derby field in a really interesting way, but it was endless. Like that march to the Derby was a baton death march to get there. And this year it'll be fun to, you know, just have this crazy action in the next couple of months. And I think there are a lot of really exciting three-year-olds. I just, you know, it's early, so you never know what they're going to shake out to be, but I think the early signs are that this is a potentially really nice crop of three-year-old colts. So we'll obviously stay on that beat as the season wears on. We'll be right back after this message from Keeneland.
They say the harder the work, the greater the reward. And this is hard work. It's the hours put in before dawn and after dark. It's the sacrifice, the sweat, the failure, and the faith. This is our industry. This is our life's work.
Owning multiple graded stakes winning racehorses like Hard Not to Love and Decorated Invader is attainable with a racing partnership like West Point Thoroughbreds. Partnerships enable you to spread your ownership across several horses for less than it costs to own one horse alone. This increases your racetrack action and chances for a big horse. Learn more about why West Point Thoroughbreds is the gold standard in racing partnerships at westpointtb.com. West Point did have an interesting horse over the weekend, Chestertown, who's starting to really come around. That big gray son of Tappet, who cost a ton of money at the OBS sale, had a really nice allowance win at Aqueduct. So I think we're gonna look for stakes action for him going forward. So congrats to the partners at West Point for a really nice win at Aqueduct. All right, so there's big news on the historical horse racing front over the past week. Now this is all a little bit over my head, so I'm gonna ask Bill to correct me if I get anything wrong. But there was a story in the past couple of months that the Kentucky Supreme Court upheld a lower court ruling in Kentucky that said that historical horse racing does not count as parimutuel wagering and therefore is banned under the Kentucky statutes. And the historical horse racing kept going for a little bit as they were trying to work out a fix or a workaround, but that all came to a head on Sunday when Keeneland and the Red Mile, which is the harness track that they jointly operate the historical horse racing operation at, shut down HHR operations. They said it's temporary as they're going to try to keep working out a fix, but you know they have to rely now on the Kentucky legislature to draw up and make up a law that redefines historical horse racing as parimutuel wagering so it can fit under the ruling of the Kentucky Supreme Court. Because obviously you're not going to go higher than that unless you go to the United States Supreme Court. And I don't think that they're going to take this up. that'd be a little ambitious to do that. But this is a big blow to Kentucky racing. Kentucky, I think, has seen a resurgence a little bit in purses in the past couple of years. Churchill Downs relies on the HHR revenue as well. And they halted the construction that they were doing on the Turfway grandstand because they said, no, we're not going to put all this capital into rebuilding this place unless we know that we're going to have that revenue again. So it really puts a stop to things in Kentucky for a little bit. My hope is that they're going to be able to convince the Kentucky legislature to, you know, make the difference here. But the problem is, you know, it's a really conservative legislature, as you would assume in Kentucky. I think it's harder. You know, the horse industry is one thing, but to get other forms of gambling passed and enacted, I think is a little bit tougher with a conservative legislature. And also, for whatever reason, they only meet for 30 days in odd numbered years, which seems like some crazy thing that, you know, was thought of in the early days when they were writing the state constitution. And no one was ever like, this doesn't seem to make any sense. But I think they only have until like March 30th or so to try to get them to, you know, do their jobs and open things up for the Kentucky horse community. And it really does benefit a lot of things, as is the case with any kind of gambling money. It really goes to a lot of good things in the state and it supports a lot of programs. And I know that there was a campaign over the weekend and this week to send letters to the Kentucky state legislature and to your legislators to try to get them to, you know, work around this and get HHR reinstated in the state. So if you're interested in that, I think we ran on Monday, maybe in the TDN. It's on Keep's website. It's on the Kentucky Equine Education Project's website. But I think we also ran something on Monday in a letter to the editor about, you know, with information about how to write an email and call your legislators if you're in Kentucky. So obviously a big deal. I hope I got the details right, but I'll pass it over to Bill now.
Yeah, I mean, you pretty much nailed the details, Joe. What happened from the first Kentucky State Supreme Court decision, there was another, and I get confused as well with all these various legal things. There was another round in court. They sent it back to the lower court, and then it came back that they were not going to approve them to be the parimutuel machine. So their avenue to get the machines back up and going through the court system has been exhausted. It's not going anyplace else. So the courts in Kentucky, I don't even think the United States Supreme Court would deal with a state issue instead of a federal issue. So, you know, that's obviously not going to happen. So really their only hope at this point is to get legislation to legalize the machines. Now, you would think that, you know, the politicians, the legislators would say, you know, this thing is great for Kentucky. Look at all this money it's bringing into the state. Look at all the jobs it's creating. Look at all the good it's done the horse racing industry, which obviously is very, very important in the state of Kentucky. And I'm sure it's important to all the legislators. But, and you touched on this a little bit, keep in mind, this is a deeply conservative, religious state. And, you know, a legislator has to decide, does he want to be seen as pro-gambling? Because that's how the, you know, there's the religious group that started all this, the Family First Foundation or something like that. You know they're going to go after anyone who is who sides for this and say, Legislator Joe Blow from XYZ County is pro-gambling. Isn't he evil and awful? Let's get rid of him. So, you know, I'm not inside Kentucky politics by any stretch of the imagination. But look, I mean, we all hope that this thing gets back up and rolling because it has put millions and millions of purses into Kentucky racing. But I'm not so sure it's anywhere close to a slam dunk. And, you know, we'll find out fairly soon. But if they lose these machines, you know, Churchill Keeneland always had good purses, but these machines are what took their purses to the stratosphere, where you see like $90,000 maiden races at Churchill Downs and that sort of thing. So it would be a huge blow to Kentucky if they lose them.
And Bill, correct me if I'm wrong, but the HHRs are basically all fictitious races, right? I mean, it's all computer generated.
Yeah, I mean, honestly, John, I played one time at Oakland Park. I put a dollar in, something happened quickly, and I lost my money. You know, that's all. I mean, they're meant to mirror slot machines as much as possible. But yes, they are based on the outcome of some race that happened at some point in time. How they all work this out and how it's done, I don't really know. I didn't ever want to see these machines go away, and I'm not going to side with the zealous religious people that got rid of these, but are they pari-mutuel gambling? You know, I mean, the racing industry says they are, but you know, it's a little bit of a stretch, no doubt about it.
Well, that's exactly my point, is that, you know, I understand racing in Kentucky. I understand the importance of the machines because they generate revenue. And I certainly am for anything that's going to help racing and help the purses. But you could, I haven't seen this argument be made yet, but you could actually think that down the road, if the historic, you know, machines ultimately take hold in a greater way, that it could remove the need for live racing altogether.
No, John, it's not. I mean, I don't think you're anywhere close on this one. You know, playing the historical horse racing machines are not handicapping. It's not horse racing. You know, it's a slot machine. Slot machine. And we found out, because, you know, well, we've had casinos and racetracks for 25 years now or whatever, the casino slot player is just a different breed, a different animal than the horse player. And don't think for a minute these historical horse racing machines are like betting on conventional horse racing. They don't even belong in the same stratosphere.
Joining a West Point Thoroughbreds partnership can vault you into the world of instant camaraderie among people surrounding high-class horses and stakes action for a fraction of the cost of trying to do it on your own. Learn more at westpointtb.com. We'll be right back after this message from West Point Thoroughbreds.
All the thrills. Fraction of the bills. Experience the power of the partnership. Change your life, make new friends, and compete at the highest level of thoroughbred racing. West Point Thoroughbreds, the gold standard in racing partnerships. Visit westpointtb.com.
The Green Group Guest of the Week is sponsored by The Green Group, an accounting, tax, consulting, and advisory firm specializing in the thoroughbred industry. With over 500 clients in the horse business, they have proven strategies to save you taxes. Learn more about how they can help you at www.greenco.com. So our Green Group Guest of the Week this week is from one of the most successful and historic farms in America, Bill Farish. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me. It's good to be here.
So we all know you from Lane's End fame, and you guys obviously do a great job over the decades. I kind of wanted to start with a little bit of a more general question. I think Lane's End has been pretty good at recruiting sires that can do well off the bat. When you're watching racing as a fan, as an owner, as a breeder, what do you look for as a recruiter of stallions that makes you think, that would be a good fit for our farm?
Well, we look for, you know, obviously race results are a big factor. We're looking for brilliance, horses that really show it. repeatedly, you know, consistently. And also, obviously, pedigree is a huge factor in what we look for. So it's, you know, kind of a combination of looks, pedigree, and race record.
Gotcha.
Hey, Bill, thanks for joining us. A lot of people on the rule that the Jockey Club has put in with 140 cap limiting the mayors to a lot of people on both sides of the fence. I believe, correct me if I'm wrong, that you and Lane's End were on the side of agreeing with the new rule and capping them at 140. So a couple of things about that. First of all, could you explain your thinking and why you were on that side of the issue? And what do you think this is going to mean for the breeding industry and stallion farms down the road so far as how the demand among stallions is spread around?
Well, I think, you know, first of all, I don't think there's as many people on the side of large books as there are on the side of limiting books. But, to me, it's quite obvious. We have literally 50% number of stallions standing in Kentucky that we did 20 years ago. And that's a direct result of increased book size. So I think looking at the list of mares bred this year, there would be literally, I think the number is about 900 mares to spread amongst other stallions from the stallions that are being bred to over 140.
And Bill, I want to flip back to a question that Joe answered, because we actually, we breed a lot. And one of the things that we're looking for in new stallions are what you mentioned, race record, pedigree, confirmation. But one of the things that I noticed in going through your roster of stallions was the trainer list. And you know, it's the John Sadlers and the Shug McGahees and Christopher Clements and you know, Todd Pletcher's, guys who have been at the top of the game and have a very good race program and a very good resume. Is the who the horse is trained by, is that also a consideration when you're looking at stallion prospects? Is the trainer itself part of the equation?
Not really. These are the obviously the most successful trainers in the country. So they tend to have more grade one winners than everyone else. So I think it's a little bit of a coincidence as to who trains them, but if a horse is showing that consistent brilliance and has the pedigree and confirmation, then we're going to go for him no matter who's training.
And just as a quick follow-up, Joe, sorry, you're introducing a couple of new stallions this year, Game Winner, Gift Box, Honor AP. They're all kind of in that $10,000 to $30,000 price point range. Is that something you look for, or is it, hey, you know, we're looking for the best horses possible, and then we kind of work backwards and figure out how much people are willing to pay in stud fees?
Yeah, I think that's really more the way it is. You know, we're obviously the, you know, if you have a Triple Crown winner, he's going to stand for more than that. So it's really what the market will bear is where we set the stud fees and trying to set a fee at a level that can be maintained, you know, for the first 4 years of his career. So, it's a case by case basis, but generally horses don't start above 50,000 unless they're just really have an exceptional race record.
You mentioned brilliance and pedigree. I think those are two things that Liam's Map definitely has. Liam's Map has been one of the early successes for you guys at Lane's End. He had a grade one winner early in his first crop. Now he's got a grade one winner on turf in Colonel Liam, who was really impressive in the Pegasus World Cup turf on Saturday. Can you talk a little bit about his impact early on and how proud you were to see him get that grade one winner on grass?
Yeah, you know, he's a son of Unbridled Song, and I think we've all been searching for the one that to carry on that sire line, and we really thought we had him in Liam's Map because he's just got the best combination of confirmation and race record that we saw from Sons of Unbridled Song. He's really, you know, a sound looking typey type of Unbridled Song, not a big rangy one. And so we were, you know, very excited about him when, you know, coming out with two grade one winning 2 year olds, Wicked Whisper and Basin, and then having Basin come back and win a grade one in the Arkansas Derby at three, really, you know, confirmed his quality. And then as you mentioned, a third grade one winner in the Pegasus World Cup turf, which was, you know, really, it looks like that horse really could have a have quite a year in 2021.
Bill, I wanted to ask you a question about racing and breeding in general. And you guys campaigned Code of Honor, who was a grade one winner as a three-year-old, and he did come back for his four-year-old year and ran in several races this year. But that is such a rarity now these days. As a matter of fact, you know, when the Breeders' Cup Classic was over, it was very disappointing for all racing fans to see that, you know, virtually every major horse in that race was retired. And we got to a point where it's so rare to see a male dirt horse who's had racing success continue on beyond the three-year-old year. Understand that it's the economics of the game. Everybody's treating it as a business as well they should. There's so much money to be made breeding horses. But do you have any bigger ideas? Because this obviously is something that is not, in general, good for the sport. How this could ever flip-flop or ever turn this around, or is it just something that this is just the way it is and people have to accept it?
Yeah, Bill, I think it's something we've all wrestled with, and we're all in agreement that, you know, if we could keep horses in training longer, it'd be great. But the, you know, if you've got races like the Pegasus, the Saudi Cup, and then the Dubai World Cup, if that's not enough to keep horses in training, I don't know what it, you know, it's not going to be just a pure money decision. So I don't know what the answer is. It's something that we'd love to see happen, but the rewards are so great at stud, and it's, you know, it's really so important to have a horse go to stud at a younger age because they have a longer career.
And Bill, I'm going to shift gears on you because the recently concluded Keeneland January sale, Lane's End was actually the leading consigner in terms of gross, and which is, you know, quite commendable. You should feel really good about that because that's a big team effort. You guys sold, you know, some tremendously expensive horses, Regal Glory for $925, Carrillo for $875, Turned Aside, Beautiful Lover, Off Topic, all for, you know, $500,000-$700,000 a piece. But the thing that really was interesting to me personally when I looked at the stats was that, you know, the sale average was like 21% RNA and you guys had under 8% RNA. What do you attribute that to? Because that's really difficult to try to nail the prices like that.
Well, it helps when you're doing a dispersal and you have no reserves.
Right.
I'd like to take total credit for and give Allaire, Ryan, total credit for that. But, you know, generally when you are doing a dispersal, and unfortunately we were doing one for Paul Pompa, who was a great friend and a real loss to the sport, you know, they were being sold with no reserve. And so subsequently you obviously don't get buybacks with those horses. But most of the horses in January that we had that were not dispersal horses were there to sell, and people had reasonable reserves on them. So, yeah, I mean, we always look at that too, but I do think in this case with the dispersal, it kind of skews the numbers.
And as a consigner, is that something that you sit down with each client when you go over reserves? I know there's different theories. So can you give our audience an idea of like what theory or rule of thumb you guys use when it comes to setting reserves?
Well, every client's different that we work with. We're you know, our job is to get the horses sold. So we're trying to encourage them to put it the reserve at a level that will get the horse sold. And generally, we value the horse before the sale, and then encourage a reserve somewhere at 2/3 of that value to try to let the horse get on the market and let bidders have a chance to buy them. So. Now, some people have a different idea of what their horse is worth than we do, and so that reserve ends up being higher. But generally, we've got a group of clients that's very interested in getting it right, so that helps.
Last question for me. Obviously, your family has been in racing for a long time. You guys have one of the great legacies of all the families that have been in the sport for the past half century or so. So I wanted to ask, as you know, as an overall perspective, what do you think has gotten better in racing as years have gone on? What do you think has gotten worse? And like, where do you think the trajectory of the sport is going? I know that's a tough question off the bat, but I wonder, as someone who has so much experience, if you could comment on that.
Well, I'm incredibly bullish on the future of the sport. I think we've got a lot of positives. You know, obviously the state of Kentucky needs to get the historic racing deal figured out, because that's a huge boost to the industry if we can keep those purses where they were heading. And you know, that the Horse Racing Integrity Act that was recently passed, I think, is hugely important for our future. We've got to get the testing right. We need to have greater integrity and more confidence from the bettors in the product. And I think that will go a long way in helping that. I was going to say restoring it, but I'm not sure it's ever been there to the degree it should be. So I think that's a huge thing. And we've, you know, again, as you mentioned earlier, the getting the book sizes regulated is an important thing, because we're just, you know, these stallions going to 250 mares is just, it's drying up the stallion market. It's hurting the farms around Kentucky. And I think it's an important thing.
Bill, getting back to Code of Honor, can you just fill us in on what his future is, if he's going to continue on with the campaign this year? And what's his future as a stallion? I assume he'll be a stallion at Lane's End someday.
Yeah, hopefully so, Bill. It's interesting, at the race, I got three or four people asked me if this was his last race, and never has that been considered. You know, we were always planning on racing him for the rest of the year, and hopefully that's, you know, hopefully, it seems like he's come out of the race fine, and you know, we'll be pointing for targets later in the summer.
Bill, one final question for me. Let's say that somebody just bought a horse in the January sale, or somebody's going to pick up a horse in the upcoming February Phasic sale, and they want to breed it to one of your stallions who's not booked, obviously. Is there an undervalued horse that you have right now where you would say, hey, I would love to have more mares to this horse because they have a tremendous pipeline, because he's undervalued, because whatever the reason is, are there one or two stallions on your roster right now that you think people are missing the boat on?
Yeah, there are. I'm glad you asked that question. Honor AP is one who I think just a phenomenal looking horse, you know, $850,000 yearling, number one highest priced in Honor Code's first crop. Grade one winner, won the Santa Anita Derby over Authentic in dominating fashion. And unfortunately, that was his last win. You know, retiring after the Derby. And if you go back and watch his race in the Derby, it was really incredible how much ground he had to make up and what a run he made. So he's a horse that, I mean, I just can't imagine a better resume. Obviously it would have been nice for him to run more times and have more grade one wins, but the races that he did run in, he was a very, very talented horse and always an it horse. So he's one at 15,000 that I just think is incredible value. The other one real quickly would be West Coast, you know, champion 3-year-old colt, AP Indy sire line, really attractive horse. And his first foals are yearlings this year. And really is one I think has a very bright future.
Bill, thank you so much for the time. Congratulations on the big win for Colonel Liam and Liam's Map, and best of luck the rest of the year.
Great. Thanks so much. Thanks for having me.
All right. Good to have you. Well done. Thank you.
The Green Group Guest of the Week is sponsored by The Green Group, an accounting, tax, consulting, and advisory firm specializing in the thoroughbred industry. As this week's Green Group Guest of the Week, Bill Farish, will receive a free 1-hour tax consultation. Learn more at greenco.com. We'll be right back after this message from The Green Group.
The Green Group is widely recognized as the top-rated tax and accounting firm specializing in the horse business. Why do the top owners, breeders, pinhookers, and trainers trust the Green Group as their tax advisors? The difference is experience. Firm founder Len Green has over 4 decades of experience owning, breeding, and racing horses. First-hand knowledge gives Green Group clients proven tax and money-saving strategies. Visit the Green Group at www.greenco.com. The Green Group, proven strategies to save you taxes.
All right, so that's going to do it for this week's edition of the TDN Writers Room, presented by Keeneland. That wagering through Keeneland Select benefits the Kentucky thoroughbred community. I want to thank John Green, Bill Finley, our Green Group Guest of the Week, Bill Farish, our producer, Patty Wolf, our associate producer, Katie Ritz, and our editors, Danny Seiper, Aaliyah LaRocca, and Anthony LaRocca. Thank you so much for watching. Please wear a mask. Enjoy the Eclipse Awards, which can be seen on the TDN homepage tomorrow from 8 to 10. We'll see you next week.